College Observatory, and professor of mathematics at the United States Naval Academy. Langley was very well connected. His friends included some of the most powerful men in government and business, including Andrew Carnegie and Alexander Graham Bell. He was also extremely well-funded. The War Department, the precursor to the Department of Defense, had given him $50,000 for the project, a lot of money in those days. Money was no object. Langley assembled some of the best and brightest minds of his day. His dream team included test pilot Charles Manley, a brilliant Cornell-trained mechanical engineer, and Stephen Bolzer, the developer of the first car in New York. Langley and his team used the finest materials, the market conditions were perfect, and the PR was great. The New York Times followed him around everywhere. Everyone knew Langley and was rooting for his success. But there was a problem. Langley had a bold goal, but he didn't have a clear sense of why. His purpose for wanting to build the plane was defined in terms of what he was doing and what he could get. He had a passion for aeronautics since he was very young, but he did not have a cause to champion. More than anything else, Langley wanted to be first. He wanted to be rich, and he wanted to be famous. That was driving his motivation. Although already well regarded in his own field, he craved the kind of fame of a Thomas Edison or an Alexander Graham Bell, the kind that only comes with inventing something big. Langley saw the airplane as his ticket to fame and fortune. He was smart and motivated. He had what we assumed to be the recipe for success, plenty of cash, the best people, ideal market conditions. But few of us have ever heard of Samuel Pierpont Langley. A few hundred miles away in Dayton, Ohio, Orville and Wilbur Wright were also building a flying machine. Unlike Langley, the Wright brothers did not have the recipe for success. Worse, they seemed to have the recipe for failure. There was no funding for their venture, no government grants, no high-level connections. The Wright brothers funded their dream with the proceeds from their bicycle shop. Not a single person working on the team, including Orville and Wilbur, had a college education. Some didn't even finish high school. What the Wright brothers were doing wasn't any different from Langley or all the others trying to build a flying machine. But the Wright brothers did something differently. What the Wright brothers were doing was special. They had a dream. They knew why it was important to build this thing. They believed that if they could figure out this flying machine, it would change the world. They imagined the benefits to everyone else if they were successful. Whereas Langley imagined the benefits to him if he was successful, the Wright brothers imagined the benefits to everyone else if they were successful. Wilbur and Orville were true scientists, deeply and genuinely concerned about the physical problem that they were trying to solve, the problem of balance and flight, said James Tobin, the Wright brothers' biographer. Langley, on the other hand, was consumed with acquiring the level of prestige of his associates, like Alexander Graham Bell, fame that he knew could only come with a major scientific breakthrough. Langley, Tobin said, did not have the Wright's passion for flight, but rather was looking for achievement. Orville and Wilbur preached what they believed and inspired others in the community to join them in their cause. The proof of their commitment was self-evident. With failure after failure, most would have given up, but not the Wright brothers' team. The team was so inspired that no matter how many setbacks they suffered, they would show up for more. Every time the Wright brothers went out to take a test flight, so the stories go, they would take 5 sets of parts with them because they knew that's how many times they would likely fail before coming home for supper that day. Then it happened. On December 17th, 1903, on the field in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, the Wright brothers took to the sky. A 59-second flight at an altitude of 120 feet at the speed of a jog was all it took to usher in a new technology that would change the world. Remarkable as the achievement was, it went relatively unnoticed. The New York Times was not there to cover the story. Driven by something bigger than fame and glory, the Wright brothers were content to wait to tell the world. They understood its true significance to the world. What Langley and the Wright brothers were trying to create was exactly the same. Both were building the same product. Both the Wright brothers and Langley were highly motivated. Both had a strong work ethic. Both had keen scientific minds. What the Wright brothers' team had that Langley didn't wasn't luck. It was inspiration. One was motivated by the prospect of fame and wealth, the other by a belief. The Wright brothers excited the human spirit of those around them. Langley paid for talent to help him get rich and famous. The Wright brothers started with why. Further proof that Langley was motivated by what? Sometime after Orville and Wilbur Wright took flight, Langley quit. Got out of the business. He could have said, "That's amazing. Now I'm going to improve upon their technology." But he didn't. He found the defeat humiliating. His own test flight had landed in the Potomac River, and the newspapers all made fun of him. He cared so much about what others thought of him. He was so preoccupied with becoming famous. He wasn't first, so he simply quit. Innovation happens at the edges. Dream teams are not always so dreamy. When a team of experts come together, they often work for themselves and not for the good of the whole. This is what happens when companies feel the need to pay mega salaries to quote-unquote get the best talent. Those people are not necessarily showing up because they believe in your why. They're showing up for the money. A classic manipulation. Paying someone a lot of money and asking them to come up with great ideas ensures very little. However, pulling together a team of like-minded people and giving them a cause to pursue ensures a great sense of teamwork and camaraderie. Langley pulled together a dream team and promised them riches. The Wright brothers inspired a group of people to join them in pursuit of something bigger than each member of the team. Average companies give their people something to work on. In contrast, the most innovative organizations give their people something to work toward. The role of a leader is not to come up with all the great ideas. The role of a leader is to create an environment in which great ideas can happen. It is the people inside the company, those on the front lines, who are best qualified to find new ways of doing things. The people who answer the phones and talk to customers, for example, can tell you more about the kinds of questions they get than can anyone sitting in an executive suite miles away. If the people inside a company are told to come to work and just do their job, that's all they'll do. But if they are constantly reminded why the company was founded and told to look for ways to bring that cause to life while performing their job, then they will do more than their job. Steve Jobs, for example, did not personally come up with the iPod or iTunes or iPhone. Others inside the company did. Jobs gave people a filter, a context, a higher purpose around which to innovate. Find existing status quo industries, those in which companies fight to protect their old-fashioned business models, and challenge them. This is why Apple was founded. It was what Jobs and Wozniak did when they started the company, and it is what Apple's people and products have done ever since. It's a repeating pattern. Apple's employees simply look for ways to bring their cause to life in as many places as they can, and it works. It is not the same at many other companies. Companies that define themselves by what they do instead of why they do it instruct their people to be more innovative around a product or service. Make it better, they're instructed. Those who work for Apple's competitors, companies that have defined themselves as quote-unquote computer manufacturers, come to work to develop, quote-unquote, more innovative computers. The best they can do is add more RAM, add a feature or two, and, as one PC maker has done, give people the option to customize the color of their computer casing. This hardly qualifies as an idea with the potential to change the course of an industry. A nice feature for sure, but it's not innovation. If you're curious as to how Colgate finds itself with 32 different types of toothpaste today, it's because every day its people come to work to develop a better toothpaste. And not, for example, to look for ways to help people feel more confident about themselves. Apple does not have a lock on good ideas. There are smart, innovative thinkers at most companies. But great companies give their people a purpose or challenge around which to develop ideas rather than simply instructing them to make a better mousetrap. Companies that study their competitors in hopes of adding the features or benefits that will make their products better are only working to entrench the company in what it does. Companies with a clear sense of why tend to ignore their competition, whereas those with a fuzzy sense of why are obsessed with what others are doing. The ability of a company to innovate is not just useful for developing new ideas, it is invaluable for navigating struggle. When people come to work with a higher sense of purpose, they find it easier to weather hard times, or even to find opportunity in those hard times. People who come to work with a clear sense of why are less prone to giving up after a few failures, because they understand the higher cause. Thomas Edison, a man definitely driven by a higher cause, said, "I didn't find a way to make a light bulb. I found a thousand ways how not to make one." Southwest Airlines is famous for pioneering the 10-minute turnaround, the ability to deplane, prep, and board a plane in 10 minutes. This ability helps an airline make more money, because the more planes that are in the sky, the better the company is doing. What few people realize is that this innovation was born out of struggle. In 1971, Southwest was running low on cash and needed to sell one of their aircraft to stay in business. This left them with three planes to fly a schedule that required four. They had two choices. They could scale back their operations, or they could figure out how to turn their planes around in 10 minutes. And thus was born the 10-minute turnaround. Whereas most other airline employees would have simply said it couldn't be done, Southwest's people rallied to figure out how to perform the unprecedented and seemingly impossible task. Today, their innovation is still paying dividends. Because of increased airport congestion and larger planes and cargo loads, Southwest now takes about 25 minutes to turn their planes around. However, if they were to try to keep the same schedule, but add even 5 minutes to the turnaround time, they would need an additional 18 planes in their fleet at a cost of nearly $1 billion to do it. Southwest's remarkable ability to solve problems, Apple's remarkable knack for innovation, and the Wright brothers' ability to develop a technology with the team they had were all possible for the same reason. They believed they could, and they trusted their people to do it. The definition of trust. Founded by Sir Francis Baring in 1762, Baring's Bank was the oldest merchant bank in England. The bank, which survived the Napoleonic Wars, World War I, and World War II, was unable to survive the predilection for risk of one self-proclaimed rogue trader. Nick Leeson single-handedly brought down Baring's Bank in 1995 by performing some unauthorized, extremely high-risk trades. Had the proverbial winds continued to blow in the right direction, Leeson would have made himself and the bank extremely rich, and he would have been hailed a hero. But such is the nature of unpredictable things like the weather and financial markets. Few dispute that what Leeson was doing was anything more than gambling. And gambling is very different from calculated risk. Calculated risk accepts that there can be great losses, but steps are taken to either guard against or respond to an unlikely but possible outcome. Even though an emergency landing on water is unlikely, as the airlines tell us, they still provide us life jackets. And if only for peace of mind, we're glad they do. To do otherwise is a gamble few other airlines would be willing to take, even though the actuarial tables are heavily weighted on their side. Leeson strangely held two positions at Baring's, ostensibly serving as both a trader and his own supervisor. But that fact is not interesting, given the subject matter. That one man had such a tolerance for risk that he could create so much damage is not very interesting either. Both of those are short-term factors. Both would have ended if Leeson had either left the company or changed jobs, or if Baring's had assigned a new supervisor to oversee his operations. What is more interesting is the culture at the bank that could allow for these conditions to exist in the first place. Baring's had lost its why. The culture at Baring's was no longer one in which people came to work inspired. Motivated, yes, but not inspired. Manipulated by the promise of massive payouts for performance for sure, but not inspired to work in the best interest of the whole. As Leeson reported in his own account of how he got away with such risky behavior for so long, he said it was not that the others didn't recognize that what he was doing was potentially dangerous. It was worse than that. There was a stigma against people speaking out. People at the London end of Baring's, Leeson explained, were all so know-it-all that nobody dared to ask stupid questions in case they would look silly in front of everyone else. the lack of a clear set of values and beliefs, along with the weak culture that resulted, created the conditions for an every-man-for-himself environment, the long-term impact of which could yield little else than disaster. This is caveman stuff. If the people aren't looking out for the community, then the benefits of a community erode. Many companies have star employees and star salesmen and so on, but few have a culture that produces great people as a rule and not an exception. Trust is a remarkable thing. Trust allows us to rely on others. We rely on those we trust for advice to help us make decisions. Trust is the bedrock for the advancement of our own lives, our families, our companies, our society, and our species. We trust those in our community to care for our children so we can go out for dinner. Given the choice between two babysitters, we're more likely to trust a babysitter with a little experience from the neighborhood than one with lots of experience from far away. We wouldn't trust someone from the outside because we don't know anything about them, we say. The reality is, we don't know anything about the local babysitter either, beyond the fact that she's from the neighborhood. In this case, we trust familiarity over experience with something quite important, the safety of our children. We trust that someone who lives in the community and more likely shares our values and beliefs is better qualified to care for the most valuable thing in our lives over someone with a long resume but from an unfamiliar place. That's pretty remarkable. It causes some pause when we consider how we hire people at work. What's more important, their resume and experience, or whether they will fit our community? Our children are probably more important than the position we want to fill at the organization. Yet we seem to exercise a very different standard at work. Is there a false assumption at play here as to who makes the best employee? Historically, trust has played a bigger role in advancing companies and society than skill set alone. Like the couple leaving their children while they go out on a date for the evening, groups from within a society would go off with confidence, knowing that their homes and families would be safe upon their return. If there was no trust, then no one would take risks. No risks would mean no exploration, no experimentation, no advancement of society as a whole. That's a remarkable concept. Only when individuals can trust the culture or organization will they take personal risks in order to advance that culture or organization as a whole. For no other reason than in the end, it's good for their own personal health and survival. No matter how experienced, no matter how proficient, a trapeze artist will not attempt a totally new death-defying leap without first trying it with a net below him. And depending on how death-defying the trick is, he may insist on always having a net when performing that trick. Besides its obvious advantage of catching you if you fall, the net also provides a psychological benefit. Knowing it is there gives the trapeze artist the confidence to try something he's never done before, or to do it again and again. Remove the net, and he will only do the safe tricks, the ones he knows he can land. The more he trusts the quality of the net, the more he will take personal risks to make his act better. The trust the circus management gives him by providing him a net is probably afforded to other performers too. All the performers will feel confident to try new things and push themselves further. That collection of personal confidence and personal risk results in the entire circus putting on a much better show. An overall better show means more customers, and the system thrives, but not without trust. For those within a community or an organization, they must trust that their leaders provide a net, practical or emotional. With that feeling of support, those in the organization are more likely to put in extra effort that ultimately benefits the group as a whole. I will admit that there are always those who will take risks for the first time or repeatedly without the net. There will always be those who will explore regardless of who is holding down the fort. These people sometimes earn their rightful spots as the innovators, the ones who pushed further, the ones who did things that no one else would do. Some of them may advance a business or even society, and some of them end up dead before they achieve anything. There is a big difference between jumping out of a plane with a parachute and jumping out of a plane without one. Both produce extraordinary experiences, but only one increases the likelihood of being able to try again another time. A trapeze artist with a personality predisposed to taking extraordinary risks without a net may be the star attraction in an otherwise mediocre show. If he dies or leaves for another circus, then what? This is the paradigm in which someone is motivated by self-gain, regardless of the consequences or the benefits to the organization for which he or she works. In such a case, the effort may be good for the individual, and it may be good for the group, but the benefits, especially for the group, come with a time limit. Over time, the system will break down, often to the detriment of the organization. Developing trust to encourage people other than those with a predilection for risk, like Nick Leeson, is a much better long-term strategy. Great organizations become great because the people inside the organization feel protected. This strong sense of culture creates a sense of belonging and acts like a net. People come to work knowing that their bosses, colleagues, and the organization as a whole will look out for them. This results in reciprocal behavior. The individual decisions, efforts, and behaviors that support, benefit, and protect the long-term interest of the organization as a whole. Southwest Airlines, a company renowned for its customer focus, does not, as a matter of policy, believe the customer is always right. Southwest will not tolerate customers who abuse their staff. They would rather those customers fly on different airlines. It's a subtle irony that one of the best customer service companies in the country focuses on its employees before its customers. The trust between the management and the employee, not dogma, is what produces great customer service. It is a prerequisite, then, for someone to trust the culture in which they work, to share the same values and beliefs of the culture. Without it, that employee, for example, is simply a bad fit, and likely to work only for self-gain without consideration for the greater good. But if those inside the organization are a good fit, the opportunity to go the extra mile, to explore, to invent, to innovate, to advance, and more importantly, to do so again and again and again increases dramatically. Real trust comes from the things you can't see. "Rambo 2," said the voice of a Brigadier General Jumper's radio, referring to him by his call sign. "Your group, 180, 25 miles, closing fast. Barnyard, radio contact," replied Rambo 2, reporting that he had picked up the enemy group on his own radar. A one-star general, John Jumper was an experienced F-15 pilot with thousands of hours of flight time and over 1,000 combat hours. By all measures, he was one of the best. Born in Paris, Texas, he had enjoyed a distinguished career. He'd flown just about everything the U.S. Air Force had, from cargo planes to fighter jets. Decorated and distinguished, the commander of his own combat wing, he was the embodiment of what it meant to be a fighter pilot. Smart and confident. But on that day, Jumper's reaction did not match the situation he faced. By 25 miles, he would have been expected to fire his weapons or take some other offensive movement. Fearing that Jumper was locked onto the wrong contact on his radar, Captain Lori Robinson calmly repeated what she could see from miles away. "Rambo 2, confirm radar contact. Your group, now 190, 20 miles. As the air weapons controller, who was watching the action on her radar screen from a nearby command and control center, it was Lori Robinson's job to direct the pilot toward the enemy aircraft so that he could use his weapons to intercept and destroy them. Unlike an air traffic controller, whose job it is to keep air traffic apart, the weapons controller has to bring the planes closer together. From the vantage point of the radar screen, only the weapons controller has the big picture, as the pilot's onboard navigational system shows only what's directly in front of the aircraft. Captain Robinson saw her job as something bigger, however, than just staring at a radar, something more profound than just being the eyes and ears for the pilots who were hurtling into harm's way at 1,500 miles per hour. Captain Robinson knew why her job was important. She saw herself as responsible for clearing a path for the pilots in her care, so that they could do what they needed to do, so they could push themselves and their aircraft further with greater confidence. And for this reason, she was unusually good at her job. Robinson couldn't make mistakes. If she did, she would lose the trust of her pilots, and worse, they would lose trust in themselves. You see, it's confidence that makes fighter pilots so good at their jobs. And then it happened. Captain Robinson could tell from the calm of Jumper's voice over the radio that he was unaware of the threat coming at him. On a cloudless day, 20,000 feet over the desert, the alarm screeched in Rambo 2's $25 million state-of-the-art fighter jet. He looked up from his radar screen and saw the enemy engaging him. Break right," he screamed into his radio. On October 9th, 1988, Brigadier General John P. Jumper was killed. Captain Robinson waited. There was an eerie calm. Before too long, Jumper stormed into the debriefing room at Nellis Air Force Base. "You got me killed," he barked at Captain Robinson. Situated in the Nevada desert, Nellis is home to the Air Force Fighter Weapons School. And on that day, General John Jumper took a direct hit from a simulated missile from another U.S. Air Force jet playing the part of an enemy combatant. "Sir, it was not my fault," Captain Robinson replied calmly. "Check the video, you'll see." General Jumper, the 57th Wing Commander, a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Fighter Weapons School, and a former instructor at Nellis, routinely evaluated every detail of every training mission he flew. Pilots often relied on the video to learn from their exercises. The video didn't lie, and it didn't on that day either. It revealed that the error was indeed his and not Captain Robinson's. It was a classic blunder. He forgot he was part of a team. He had forgotten what made him so good at his job was not just his ability. Jumper was one of the best because there were others who were looking out for him. A massive infrastructure of people he couldn't see. Without question, General Jumper had been given the best equipment, the best technology, and the best training that money could buy. But it was the mechanics, the teachers, his fellow pilots, the culture of the Air Force, and Captain Robinson who ensured that he could trust himself to get the job done. General Jumper forgot why he was so good and made a split-second decision that cost him his life. But this is what training is for, to learn those lessons. Some 16 years after his lesson over the Nevada desert, General Jumper went on to big things. Now a retired four-star general, he served as Chief of Staff of the Air Force from 2001 to 2005, the highest-ranking uniformed office in the entire Air Force, responsible for the organization, training, and equipping of nearly 700,000 active-duty, guard, reserve, and civilian forces serving in the United States and overseas. As a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he, along with the other service chiefs, advised the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Council and the President. This is not, however, a story about General Jumper. This is a story about General Lori Robinson. Now herself a Brigadier General in the U.S. Air Force, she no longer has her face down a scope. There are no more bogeys and bandits, the Air Force's nicknames for the good guys and the bad guys, in her life. Even though her job has changed, General Robinson still starts every day by reminding herself why she came to work. As much as she misses her kids, as she called those who served under her command, General Robinson is still looking for ways she can clear a path for others so that they can push themselves and the organization further. The time to think of yourself is done. It is not about you. It is about the lieutenants behind you, she'd remind her students when she was an instructor at the Fighter Weapons School. If enough of us do this, she goes on, referring to why she does what she does, then we leave this military and this country in better shape than we found it. And isn't that the point? And it is that sense of purpose, a clear idea of why she comes to work, that has been the cornerstone of General Robinson's success. And that, incidentally, has been remarkable. Working hard to clear a path for others so that they can confidently go on to do bigger and better things has in turn inspired others to clear a path for General Robinson to do exactly the same thing. As a woman in a very masculine world of the military, she sets an example for how to lead. Great leadership is not about flexing and intimidation. Great leaders, as General Robinson proves, lead with why. They embody a sense of purpose that inspires those around them. General Robinson was so trusted as a weapons controller that it was not unusual for pilots in training to request that she be assigned to them. The greatest compliment I ever got was when people would say, "When I go to war, I want Lori on the radio," she says. She is the first woman in the history of the Air Force to command the 552nd Air Control Wing out of Tinker Air Force Base, one of the largest wings in the Air Combat Command, the wing that flies the AWACS airborne control aircraft, the fleet of Boeing 707s with the huge rotating radar dishes on top. She is the first commander of a combat wing who ever didn't come up through the pilot ranks. She was the first female weapons school instructor to teach at the Air Force Fighter Weapons School, where the Air Force trains all its top guns. There, she became the most celebrated teacher in the ranks, winning Best Teacher 7 classes in a row. She's the first female director of the Secretary of the Air Force and Chief of Staff of the Air Force Executive Action Group. And in 2000, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said of General Robinson, at the time still a captain, that she singularly influenced his ideas on air power. And the list goes on and on. By any measure, General Lori Robinson is a remarkable leader. Some in management positions operate as if they're in a tree of monkeys. They make sure that everyone at the top of the tree looking down sees only smiles, but all too often, those at the bottom looking up see only asses. Great leaders like General Robinson are respected by those both above and below. Those in her command trust her implicitly because they know she's committed to looking after them. "There's nothing that you can do wrong that I can't fix," she was often heard telling students at Fighter Weapons School, and those to whom she reports show remarkable deference to her. "I don't know how she gets away with half the stuff she does," say those who know her. More importantly, it is said with a grin and with respect. General Robinson's ability to lead developed not because she's the smartest or the nicest. She's a great leader because she understands that earning the trust of an organization doesn't come from setting out to impress everyone. It comes from setting out to serve those who serve her. It is the invisible trust that gives a leader the following they need to get things done. And in Lori Robinson's case, things get done. I use the military because it exaggerates the point. Trust matters. Trust comes from being a part of a culture or organization with a common set of values and beliefs. Trust is maintained when the values and beliefs are actively managed. If companies do not actively work to keep their golden circle in balance, clarity, discipline, and consistency, then trust starts to break down. A company, indeed any organization, must work actively to remind everyone why the company exists, why it was founded in the first place, what it believes. They need to hold everyone in the company accountable to the values and guiding principles. It's not enough to just write them on the wall. That's passive. Bonuses and incentives must revolve around them. The company must serve those whom they wish to serve it. With balance, those who are good fits can trust that everyone is on board for the same reasons. It's also the only way that each individual in the system can trust that others are acting to leave the organization in a better way than we found it. To quote General Robinson again, this is the root of passion. Passion comes from feeling like you are part of something bigger. It comes from the feeling that you are part of something you believe in. If people do not trust that a company is organized to advance the why, then the passion becomes diluted. Without managed trust, people will show up to do their jobs and they will worry primarily about themselves. This is the root of office politics. People acting within the system for self-gain, often at the expense of others, even the company. If a company doesn't manage trust, then those working for it will not trust the company, and self-interest becomes the overwhelming motivation. This may be good for the short term, but over time, the organization will get weaker and weaker. Herb Kelleher, the visionary behind Southwest Airlines, understood this better than most. He recognized that to get the best out of his employees, he needed to create an environment in which they felt like the company cared about them. He knew that they would naturally excel if they felt the work they did made a difference. When a journalist asked Kelleher who comes first, his shareholders or his employees, his response was heresy at the time, and to a large degree still is. "Well, that's easy," he said. "Employees come first, and if employees are treated right, they treat the outside world right. The outside world uses the company's product again, and that makes the shareholder happy. That is really the way it works, and it's not a conundrum at all." The influence of others. Who do you trust more, someone you know or someone you don't know? What do you trust more, a claim made in a piece of advertising or a recommendation from a friend? Who do you trust more, the waiter who tells you everything on the menu is great or the waiter who tells you to avoid the chicken casserole? Are these questions too easy? Then how about this one? Why should anyone trust you? Personal recommendations go a long way. We trust the judgment of others. It's part of the fabric of a strong culture. But we don't trust the judgment of just anyone. We are more likely to trust those who share our values and beliefs. When we believe someone has our best interest in mind because it's to their benefit to do so, the whole group benefits. The advancement of societies was based on a great deal of trust between those with a common set of values and beliefs. The feeling of trust is lodged squarely in the same place as the why, the limbic brain, and it's often powerful enough to trump empirical research or at least seed doubt. This is the reason why so many manipulations are effective. We believe that, for better or for worse, others know more than we do. Clearly, 4 out of 5 dentists know more than we do when choosing chewing gum, but what about the one holdout? What did he know that the others didn't? Of course we trust the celebrity endorsements. Those celebs are rich and can use any product they want. It must be good if they're putting their reputation on the line to promote it, right? You probably answered that question in your head already. Clearly they are endorsing the product because they are getting paid to do it. But if celebrity endorsements didn't work, companies wouldn't use them. Or perhaps it's the fear that they might work that fuels the multi-million dollar wink and a smile that encourages us to choose one car over another or one lipstick over another. The fact is, none of us is immune to the effect of someone we know or feel like we trust influencing our decisions. Celebrity endorsements are used with this concept in mind. By using a recognizable face or name, so the assumption goes, people will more likely trust the claims being made. The flaw in this assumption is that celebrity status alone may work to influence behavior, but at this level, it's just peer pressure. For it to work, the celebrity needs to represent the same clear cause or belief. An athlete known for her work ethic may have some value to a company with the same belief, for example, or an actor known for his charitable work would be a good fit for a company doing good. In these cases, it is clear that both the company and the celebrity are working together to advance the same cause. I recently saw an ad for a TD Ameritrade that featured morning show hosts Regis Philbin and Kelly Ripa. I'm still trying to figure out the cause that two talk show hosts represent and how that matters when it comes to choosing one bank over another. When a company says that a celebrity represents, quote, the kind of qualities we want our customers to associate with us, they miss the point. The celebrity is another what to the company's why. The celebrity must embody the qualities that already exist at the company. Without clarity of why, any benefit will amount to simply increasing recognition. So many decisions, and indeed contract negotiations, are based on an advertising industry measurement called a Q-score, a quotient of how well recognized a celebrity is, how famous they are, so to speak. The higher the score, the better the unaided awareness of the celebrity. This information alone is not enough. The clearer the spokesperson's own why is understood, the better ambassador they can be for a like-minded brand or company. But there is no measurement of a celebrity's why currently available. So the result is obvious. The value of too many celebrity endorsements is the celebrity appeal alone. Unless the audience to which you are trying to appeal gets a sense of what the spokesperson believes, unless that spokesperson is one of us, the endorsement may drive recognition. It may even drive sales for the short term, but it will fail to build trust. A trusted recommendation is powerful enough to trump facts and figures and even multi-million dollar marketing budgets. Think of a young father who wants to do everything right for his newborn child. He decides he's going to get a new car, something safe, something to protect his child. He spends a week reading all the magazines and reports. He's seen all the advertising and decides that on Saturday he's buying a Volvo. The facts are in and his mind is made up. The Friday night before, he and his wife head to a dinner party. Standing by the punch bowl is their friend, the local car enthusiast. Our intrepid new father walks up to his friend and proudly announces that, as a new father, he's decided to buy a Volvo. Without a thought, his friend replies, "Why would you do that? Mercedes is the safest car on the road. If you care about your kid, you'll get a Mercedes." Playing on his desires to be a good father, but also trusting his friend's opinion, one of three things will happen. Our young father will either change his mind and buy a Mercedes, he will go forward with his original decision, but not without some doubt about whether he's indeed doing the right thing or not, or he will go back to the drawing board and redo all his research in order to reassure himself of his decision. No matter how much rational information he has at his fingertips, unless that decision also feels right, stress will go up and confidence will go down. However you slice it, the opinions of others matter. The question isn't how should car companies talk to the father who bought the car. The question isn't even how they court the highly influential opinion of his friend, the car guy. The concept of buyer and influencers isn't a new one. The question is, how do you get one of the influencers to talk about you so that you can make the system tip? Chapter 7. How a tipping point tips. If I told you I knew a company that invented an amazing new technology that will change the way we consume television, would that pique your interest? Perhaps you'd be interested in buying their product or investing in their company. It gets better. They have the single best product available. Their quality is through the roof, way better than anything else on the market. And their PR efforts have been so remarkable, they have even become a household name. Interested? This is the case of TiVo, a company that seemed to have everything going for them, but it turned out to be a commercial and financial failure. Since they seemed to have the recipe for success, TiVo's flop defied conventional wisdom. Their struggles, however, are easily understood if you consider that they thought what they did mattered more than why. They also ignored the law of diffusion of innovations. In 2000, Malcolm Gladwell created his own tipping point when he shared with us how tipping points happen in business and in society. In his aptly named book, The Tipping Point, Gladwell identifies groups of necessary populations he calls connectors and influencers. With little doubt, Gladwell's ideas are spot on, but it still begs the question, why should an influencer tell anyone about you? Marketers are always trying to influence the influencers, but few really know how. We can't dispute that tipping points happen and the conditions that Gladwell articulates are right, but can a tipping point happen intentionally? They can't just be an accidental phenomenon. If they exist, then we should be able to design one. And if we can design one, we should be able to design one that lasts beyond the initial tip. It's the difference between a fad and an idea that changes an industry or society forever. In his 1962 book, Diffusion of Innovations, Everett M. Rogers was the first to formally describe how innovations spread through society. 30 years later, in his book, Crossing the Chasm, Jeffrey Moore expanded on Rogers' ideas to apply the principle to high-tech product marketing. But the law of diffusion of innovations explains much more than just the spread of innovation or technology. It explains the spread of ideas. If you don't know the law, you likely are already familiar with some of its terminology. Our population is broken into five segments that fall across a bell curve. The innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, and laggards. As the law states, the first 2.5% of the population are the innovators, and the next 13.5% of the population are our early adopters. Innovators, Moore says, pursue new ideas and new products aggressively and are intrigued by any fundamental advance. Being first is a central part of their lives. As their name suggests, innovators are the small percentage of the population that challenge the rest of us to see and think of the world a little differently. Early adopters are similar to innovators in that they appreciate the advantages wrought by new ideas and technologies. They are early to recognize the value of new ideas and are quite willing to put up with imperfection because they can see the potential. Although quick to see the potential and willing to take the risks to try the new technologies or ideas, early adopters are not idea generators like the innovators. But both groups are similar, as Moore says, in that they rely heavily on their intuition. In other words, they trust their gut. Early adopters, like innovators but to a lesser degree, are willing to pay a premium or suffer some level of inconvenience to own a product or espouse an idea that feels right. Those on the left side of the diffusion curve are the ones who stood in line for 6 hours to be among the first to buy the iPhone, Apple's entry into the mobile phone market, even though they could have walked into the store a week later and bought it without waiting at all. Their willingness to suffer an inconvenience or pay a premium had less to do with how great the product was and more to do with their own sense of who they are. They wanted to be first. These are also the personality types who bought flat-screen TVs when they first came out, even though they cost upwards of $40,000 and the technology was still far from perfected. My friend Nathan fits this profile. I walked around his house once and counted no fewer than 12 Bluetooth earpieces for his mobile phone laying around his house. I asked him why he had so many. "Did they all break?" I queried. "No," he replied. "They came out with a new one." There was also about 5 laptops and various models of Blackberries and other smartphones and boxes of other gadgets laying about that never quite worked well. Nathan is an early adopter. The next 34% of the population are the early majority, followed by the late majority, and finally the laggards on the far right side of the spectrum. Laggards are the ones who buy touch-tone phones only because they don't make rotary phones anymore. The early and late majority are more practical-minded. For them, rational factors matter. The early majority is slightly more comfortable with new ideas or technologies, while the late majority is not. The farther right you go on the curve, the more you will encounter the clients and customers who may need what you have but don't necessarily believe what you believe. As clients, they are the ones for whom, no matter how hard you work, it's never enough. Everything usually boils down to price with them. They are rarely loyal. And sometimes you may even wonder out loud why you still do business with them. They just don't get it, our gut tells us. The importance of identifying this group is so that you can avoid doing business with them. Why invest good money and energy to go after people who, at the end of the day, will do business with you anyway if you meet their practical requirements, but will never be loyal if you don't? It's not too hard to recognize where people fall on the spectrum once you're in a relationship with them. The opportunity is to figure out which is which before you decide to work with them. We all sit at different places on the spectrum depending on the product or idea. Most of us are fiercely loyal to certain products and ideas at various times and demonstrate left side of the curve behavior. And for other products or ideas, we exhibit right side of the curve behavior. When we sit on one side of the spectrum, we often have a hard time understanding those on the other side because their behavior doesn't make sense to us. My sister Sarah is an early adopter when it comes to fashion trends, whereas I'm firmly in the late majority. It was only recently that I finally caved and bought a pair of overpriced designer blue jeans. I admit they look good, but I still think they aren't worth the money, and I can't understand why my sister thinks they are. In contrast, I'm an early adopter for some technologies. I bought a Blu-ray DVD player before they had perfected the technology. I paid about 4 or 5 times more for it compared to a regular DVD player. My sister cannot understand why I waste my money on all this useless stuff, as she puts it. We will never see eye to eye in this stuff. Each of us assigns different values to different things, and our behaviors follow accordingly. This is one of the major reasons why it's nearly impossible to convince someone of the value of your products or ideas based on rational arguments and tangible benefits. It's the old Ferrari and Honda Odyssey debate again. Designer jean companies, or my sister, can talk to me until they are blue in the face about the importance of fabric quality, design, and workmanship. It goes in one ear and out the other. Similarly, it can be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt the rational benefits of choosing a $500 DVD player over a $100 one. My sister won't hear a word of it. And so the game of manipulation ensues. Again, although always effective, manipulations don't breed loyalty, and they increase the costs and the stress for all parties involved. Most people or organizations that have something to sell, be it a product, service, or idea, hope to achieve some level of mass market success or acceptance. Most hope to penetrate the bell of the curve. Getting there, however, is easier said than done. When you ask small businesses about their goals, many of them will tell you that they want to be billion-dollar businesses in X number of years. The odds of that happening, unfortunately, don't look good. Of the 27 million registered businesses in the United States, fewer than 2,000 ever reach $1 billion in annual revenues. And 99.9% of all businesses in America have fewer than 500 employees. In other words, mass market success is really hard to achieve. Big companies have similar challenges repeating their mass market success. Just because they've done it once or twice doesn't mean they know how to do it every time. The Zune, Microsoft's entry into the multi-gigabyte MP3 player market, for example, was pegged to, quote-unquote, take on the iPod. It didn't happen. Even if the quality was superior, there is more to succeeding than just the product and the marketing. Don't forget, the superior Betamax technology did not beat out the substandard VHS technology as the standard format for videotape in the 1980s. The best does not always win. Like any natural law, the law of diffusion must be considered if mass market acceptance is important to you. Refusal to do so will cost a lot of money and may result in a mediocre success, if not complete failure. There is an irony to mass market success, as it turns out. It's near impossible to achieve if all you do is point your marketing and resources to the middle of the bell, to the mass market. If you attempt to woo those who represent the middle of the curve without first appealing to the early adopters. It can be done, but at great expense. This is because the early majority, according to Rogers, will not try something until someone else has tried it first. The early majority, indeed the entire majority, need the recommendation of someone else who has already sampled the product or service. They need to know someone else has tested it. They need that trusted, personal recommendation. According to the law of diffusion, mass market success can only be achieved after you've penetrated between 15 and 18% of the market. That's because the early majority won't try something new until someone else has tried it first. This is why we have to drop our prices or offer value-added services. We're attempting to reduce the risk tolerance of those practical-minded people until they feel comfortable to buy. That's what a manipulation is. They may buy, but they won't be loyal. Don't forget, loyalty is when people are willing to suffer some inconvenience or pay a premium to do business with you. They may even turn down a better offer from someone else, something the late majority rarely does. The ability to get the system to tip is the point at which the growth of the business or the spreading of an idea starts to move at an extraordinary pace. It is also at this point that a product gains mass market acceptance, the point at which an idea becomes a movement. When that happens, the growth is not only exponential, it's automatic. And it just goes. The goal of business, then, should not be simply to sell to anyone who wants what you have, the majority, but rather to find the people who believe what you believe, the left side of the bell curve. They perceive greater value in what you do and will happily pay a premium or suffer some sort of inconvenience to be a part of your cause. They are the ones who, on their own volition, will tell others about you. That 15 to 18% is not made up of people who are simply willing to buy the product. It is the percentage of people who share your beliefs and want to incorporate your ideas, your products, and your services into their lives as what's to their own whys. They look to what you do as a tangible element that demonstrates their own purpose, cause, or belief to the outside world. Their willingness to pay a premium or suffer inconvenience to use your product or service says more about them than it does about you and your products. Their ability to easily see why they need to incorporate your products into their lives makes this group the most loyal customers of all. They are the most loyal shareholders of all, and they are the most loyal employees of all. No matter where they sit in the spectrum, these are the people who not only love you, but talk about you. Get enough of the people on the left side of the curve on your side, and they encourage the rest to follow. I love asking businesses what their conversion on their new business efforts may be. Many answer proudly, 10%. If you ignore the principles of the Golden Circle, the law of averages says you can win about 10% of the business. Throw enough spaghetti against the wall and some of it sticks. To grow the business, all you need to do is more prospecting, which is why growing your business by aiming at the middle of the curve is so expensive. Though the business may grow, the average will stay about the same, and 10% is not enough for the system to tip. Likewise, 10% of your existing customers or clients will naturally show loyalty to you. But why are they so loyal? Like an inability to explain why we love our spouses, the best we can muster up to explain what makes them such great clients is they just get it. And though this explanation may feel right, it is completely unactionable. How do you get more people to get it? This is what Moore refers to as the chasm, the transition between the early adopters and the early majority, and it's hard to cross, but not if you know why. If you have the discipline to focus on the early adopters, the majority will come along eventually. But it must start with why. Simply focusing on so-called influencers is not enough. The challenge is, which influencers? There are those who seem to fit the influencer profile more than others, but in reality, we are all influencers at different times for different reasons. You just don't want any influencer. You want someone who believes what you believe. Only then will they talk about you without any prompts or incentives. If they truly believe in what you believe, and if they are truly on the left side of the curve, they won't need to be incentivized. They'll do it because they want to. The entire act of incentivizing an influencer is manipulative. It renders the influencer completely inauthentic to his or her group. It won't take long for the group to find out that a recommendation wasn't made with the group's best interest in mind, but rather because of one person's self-interest. Trust erodes, and the value of the influencer is rendered useless. Refusing to consider the law of diffusion will cost you. In 1997, TiVo was racing to market with a remarkable new device. Few would debate that from the time the product was introduced to this current day, TiVo has the single highest quality product in its category. The company's PR has been extraordinary. They have achieved an unaided awareness that most brands can only dream of. They have become more than generic terms like Kleenex, Band-Aids, and Q-tips. In fact, they've been able to achieve more than generic status. They've become a verb in the English language, to TiVo. They were well-funded with venture capital and had a technology that could truly reinvent how we consume television. The problem was, they marketed their technology directly to the middle of the bell curve. Seeing the mass market appeal of the product, they ignored the principles of the law of diffusion and targeted to the masses. Compounding that bad aim, they attempted to appeal to the cynical majority by explaining what the product did instead of stating why the company or the product existed in the first place. They attempted to convince with features and benefits. They basically said to the mass market, we've got a new product. It pauses live TV, skips commercials, rewinds live TV, memorizes your viewing habits, and records shows on your behalf without you needing to set the device. Analysts were intrigued by the prospects of TiVo, as well as its competitor, Replay, a well-funded startup backed by venture capital. One market researcher estimated that these so-called personal TV receivers would reach 760,000 subscribers by the end of the first year. TiVo finally shipped in 1999. Mike Ramsey and Jim Barton, two former colleagues who had founded TiVo, were certain the TV viewing public was ready. And they may have been, if only TiVo knew how to talk to them. But despite the excitement among the analysts and technophiles, sales were hugely disappointing. TiVo sold about 48,000 units the first year. Meanwhile, Replay, whose backers included the founders of Netscape, failed to gain a following and instead became embroiled in a dispute with television networks over the way it allowed viewers to skip ads. In 2000, the company adopted a new strategy and a few months later was sold to Sonic Blue, which later filed for bankruptcy. Analysts were stumped as to why the TiVo machines weren't selling. The company seemed to have everything going for it. After all, they had the recipe for success, a great quality product, money, and ideal market conditions. In 2002, after TiVo had been on the market for nearly 3 years, a headline in Advertising Age summed it up best. More U.S. homes have outhouses than TiVos. At the time, there were 671,000 homes with outhouses in the United States compared to 514,000 homes with TiVo. Not only were sales poor, but the company has not fared well for its shareholders either.